sometimes I don't stand up after introductions because I think, who's that bloke? Who is at all? I'm going to read mostly from that new collection, Remarkable Occurrences, and I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. But I'm going to start with the title poem from my previous collection, which is called Shenanigans. For no reason, really, except I like it. I play the fox. What else do you expect in this moony garden? You stand alone at the window, tall, white as down, staring as if I was some will-o'-the-wisp, a green-eyed seducer versed with pulpit words. Actually, can I start again? Yeah, do you mind?
Do you know what? I'm just afraid that's going to collapse and don't lead too heavily.
Well, I have to lead on something.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'll start again because, sorry, I was a little nervous starting there. I live in Leeds, and about 2 years ago, there was a newspaper article about a woman who lived in a Leeds suburb who each morning was finding a shoe on her doorstep, just one man's shoe on the doorstep. And she was very nervous about this and called the police, and the police staked it out. And it turned out to be a fox who each night was bringing one shoe and leaving it on the doorstep and then going, basically. And the poem really is about that, but it is about the fox rather than the lady or the shoe. At the time, I was doing some research on the folklore of foxes, so there's an awful lot of folkloric bits in this. I'm sorry, I should have explained that at the beginning, but I'll start again. Shenanigans. I play the fox. What else do you expect in this moony garden? You stand alone at the window, tall, white as down, staring as if I was some will-o'-the-wisp, a green-eyed seducer versed with pulpit words. Nightly, I have come to you with a sermon of shoes. Brogues, Balmorals, wingtips, winkle pickers, trainers and loafers. Trophies lifted from careless men, cradled in this cunning grin, laid out for review and match. I preach a choice, silly goose. Let each man claim his own. Tie you tight as a lace. But don't be deceived by any glib-tongued spiel. Test the snout, the brush, the shining pelt of it. My fox paws are real. Make no mistake. The woods call us. Stay wild and free. Put on your dancing shoes, step out, trot a tricksy measure with me. So I'm going to read now from the new collection, which was published in Ireland on August the 1st. I'll do that. It's pretty new. Hasn't yet been published in England. And I'm going to start with a poem about roadkill. It isn't really, but it started with some roadkill. It's called Vernal Equinox. I swear I saw the spirit of the hare festal in the half of night that now becomes day. Rise up from the bloodshot tarmac, from the blatant bones, from the visceral forfeit, gather in, complete and lithe, ears raised, nose twitching, eyes seeing clear, unmoving for a moment, then springing aloft, transparent, unbroken, faultless, ascending through air to fire that consumes breath itself, an ardent thread, a filament that shone in the firmament, embossed above, a light alone, pure. I saw, I swear. Thank you. The next poem I read is, again, needs a bit of explanation. I live in, close to the city of Leeds, and Leeds is a city of sanctuary, a welcoming city to refugees and asylum seekers. And I worked for, or volunteered for a charity that worked with asylum seekers and refugees. And we had particularly, as you'd expect, I suppose, sadly, quite a lot of Syrian refugees came to Leeds. And this poem is not any one refugee's story. It's an amalgam of one or two. It's called Eastern Ghouta, which, as you probably remember, is a suburb of Damascus that was the first to be levelled, really, by Assad's Russian allies and Assad's artillery. Eastern Ghouta. She dusts off the wooden box her mother gave in another life. A star emerges in cellar gloom, interlaced strips of dreams, seen now only in veneers, peach, apricot, walnut, rose. Inlaid is nacre, lustrous as evening brushed hair. Look at this, daughter, and be calmed, she said on that special day. She opens the box, takes out a lipstick, a shard of glass from her grandmother's mirror that had hung forever in the hall. Carefully, she paints her mouth. Rose-lipped wife, her husband smiled once. If he does not return and the soldiers come, she will use the glass. She will bloom again. Okay. Carrying on the cheery tone, or at least the Leeds connection, this is, in a sense, I suppose, a poem about the First World War. As introduced, my family's originally from Kinsale, and I get into a lot of, not arguments, but discussions about the war. It is, as I'm sure you're aware better than I am, a contested area, to some extent, in Ireland. But my grandfather was in the Connacht Rangers and fought in the First World War, so it's less contested for me, in a sense. But also, I spent a lot of time in and around Leeds, obviously, as I live there. And this story is a kind of homage, I suppose, if you like, to the Leeds pals. A very brief introduction. In order to encourage recruitment in the First World War, the government decided that it would offer special terms to groups of people who wanted to all volunteer together. Pals regiments, they became known as. So whole workplaces would volunteer together. Whole villages would send their young. And, of course, they signed up, and, of course, they died as friends and pals, and left villages empty, left factories empty, particularly the fabric factories around Leeds. And it was the 100th anniversary, when I wrote this, of the first day of the Battle of the Somme, in which the Leeds pals virtually disappeared. They got up out of their trenches. They were asked to lay down in the mist before the battle started, about 30 or 40 yards away from the trench they'd left. And then they just marched into machine guns. Fired by equally young men on the German side. This isn't a pro-anything, it's just anti-stupidity. Right? The opening phrase, and indeed it's a closing phrase, comes from a German machine gunner, Otto Leis, whose memoirs of the first day of the Somme are translated into English. It's called 0815. My German's terrible, forgive me. 0815. It was the registration number for the Maxim machine gun, which both sides used, but the German infantry used it more than anyone else. And it fired 500 rounds a minute, which, if you do the calculation, leaves 0.12 of a second in between each round. Null act one the same for the Leeds Pals. Forward. Feed. Back. Tack. 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 Bullets with dumb logic stammer across the broken field. Each leaves a momentary hush. In its wake, a million pauses in the chatter of a morning's killing. Stitch these seconds together to quilt an undying conversation for the tongue-tied pals. Called out that morning from trenches to lie down in a memory of quiet meadows, comfortable in themselves, like parting lovers who don't need to say anything in the short time left to them as whole. These cloth-eared evangelists who once heard the brassy call, though some may conjure a lark singing, now strain with shell-dumb ears to hear a whistle jab the tranquility. They stand up, adjust themselves, as if stepping out for a modest stroll, jag forward into 0.12 seconds of silence, wherein lay all that remained to them, until remembrance returns these soldiers to village and town, when, smiling, they might wander among us, gathered, wondering at what we have become, at how well we have used their gift. Forward, feed, back, tack, tack, tack. Thank you. That was the one that was involved in the Leeds Peace Prize. Ah, yes. One of my favourite painters is Caravaggio. I say that because I can't introduce the poem in any other way. He is actually one of my favourite painters. And I was in Rome once, and there's a chapel there called the Cesari Chapel, Church of Santa Maria del Popolo, if I remember rightly. There's a huge altar and stuff, but there's a side altar with two Caravaggio paintings there. One of the crucifixion of St. Peter, and one of St. Paul on the road to Damascus. You don't have to be familiar with them, but they're both staggering paintings on either side of an altarpiece by another painter. But they're always kept in darkness for some reason, I never understood. And this is called Light Up Caravaggio. Light up, Caravaggio. The sign on the brass box tempts. Wanderers, ghostly in their gloom, wait for the first to crack. A tourist drops a euro in the slot. The world becomes fluorescent, as if lightning had struck. For a few minutes, we are actors, aghast in saintly altar visions. Paul, like us, falls flat on his way to righteousness. The world's a horse's arse, blocking the divine light that's poked out his eyes. He's shafted. No reason in it. Perhaps Peter thought it through, though his world's turned topsy-turvy. A euro's worth of radiance proves a shocker. He blinks, as if just noticing his nailed palm, the sweaty efforts to exalt souls heavenward. And the painter, exposed to acres of holy canvas, but still at heart leaden, a Saturnalian, lit up in the brothels, dressed to kill, swinging sex like a sword, he clubbed light into corners, the better to shadow his own virile misery, burning the candle at both ends until bad blood and the bright sun spiked him in some Tuscan hole. At least he sucked it up while he could. Deny it as many times as you like, but at a stretch, we're all bound to walk that walk, like it or not. Clockwork ticks on. Brilliance dims. Plink! Coin falls. The chapel recedes. Unaltered souls, we're out of this prison of devout darkness, sharpish. Time to hit the bars. Time to lighten up. Okay. This book's called Remarkable Occurrences. Half of the book is a very long sequence, half of the book is a sequence of poems about Captain James Cook's first circumnavigation of the world. It's the 250th anniversary of it. And I live quite close to where Cook was born and where his boat, the Endeavour, was built. And I became quite intrigued by Cook. I was going to say, I don't think he ever sailed to Cork, but then I'm walking here tonight, I passed Cook Street, so maybe he moored his boat there, I don't know. I doubt it. But I became fascinated by the voyage. For reasons I'm still not quite clear about, which is a shame because half the book's written about it, but I'm still not absolutely certain. There was this kind of element of, I mean, you all remember Star Trek, which to some extent derived a lot of what it was doing from Cook, Kirk, Endeavour, Enterprise. It was quite intriguing, that sense that you never knew what was on the next planet, around the next rock, or on the next piece of cardboard pretending to be a rock. And what gripped me about the voyage was that no one on the voyage really knew entirely what it might mean, what they were actually doing. Neither the crew nor the people they met, the Maoris in New Zealand, the inhabitants of Australia, been there 56,000 years, but nobody, again, really knew the import of it. Neither had become the other at that point. It was quite magical in a sense. All was changed, but all stayed the same on the boat as well. Confucius once said that wherever you go, there you are. And that seemed to me part of the Cook thing as well. So it's difficult to pick poems out of the sequence, but I'm going to read two that kind of stand alone. And one is called, the first one I'll read is called The Song of the Tupa Taku, which is a Maori word for corpse. And I think the tribes that the Cook engaged with had a tremendous sense of humour because they'd half spin some lines to Cook, which of course they believed because this is Star Trek, you know. Why should you not believe what you're told in these strange places? There's some evidence that this was true, but who knows? This is called The Song of the Tupa Taku. There is a seal in the bay, or there is a mermaid in the bay. You may believe anything here, when even the light of reason dims. It's a body, female, unbound, bellying in the swell. Well, we're told there are no graves here, no pomposity of ceremony. Death is a secret place. A corpse, tethered to a stone, splashes into the bay's depths. That might be it for eternity. An image is disconcerting me. The seabed of the bay and beyond, gravid with the weighted dead, pinned like underwater kites, all float upright, roped by ankle, all look seaward, vibrating imperceptibly in the slack water as if tuned to a higher wavelength. Nervous, they flutter, shy virgins on the edge, hoping to dance a slow undersea cotillion, waiting for partners, waiting for us. Okay? Mm. And the second one I'll read is called The Song of the Severed Head. The Cook's crew had expectations about what they'd find. cannibalism being one of the things that they were convinced they would find. And they were both collectors of things. They traded and bartered. They were already thinking about what they would be able to display when they got back to London. And one of the key characters on the voyage, who I came to like quite a bit, was a man called Joseph Barnes. He was he paid to travel. He paid something like £500,000 in today's currency, £10,000 in those days, to travel. He was a collector, a scientist. He became a fellow of the Royal Society, president of the Royal Society in later on. And he was an avid collector. And he was determined to collect anything that was given to him. And he wanted particularly a severed head, which were quite not uncommon amongst the Maori people. They were kept for various reasons. So this is kind of his perspective. Song of the Severed Head. A severed head is just that. No more, no less disengaged than you would expect of a hairy scalp, a face of skin, a bone box cluttered now with plaques. A bargain made at musket point for one who will no more wonder at the stars seen from a canoe, who will not again see sunrise over sea nor speak of mysteries in moon-bathed symposiums. Such sentimentality, better suited to romantic notions, I fear. Yet this new world is inscrutable. Its sublime novelties assail us daily, and might leave us, like you now, blind, mute, fumbling to comprehend it, might render these overburdened brains unable to fashion a logical account. No, reason is always the key. We are ingenious, logical, clear-headed, not starry-eyed. Our science will improve man's estate. Yours was no more than ingenuity, enough to get by in this far corner, until we exposed the world outside. It is us who crossed oceans. You, worth a pair of old linen drawers, must swing carelessly in my cabin. And that was one of the things that always struck me. They really didn't know what they were doing at all. And when they came back, they weren't particularly sure either what they'd done. So much changed as a result of that faintly innocent interaction. I was asked to read in New Zealand in November, which is the 250th anniversary, and I kind of undernarred about it, but I didn't really want to do it because it's very contested. That the Maori peoples have no interest in celebrating Cook at all, for reasons which are bloody obvious. And you know, one doesn't really want to be part of something that is either done on in the corner, away from everything, or is not actually welcomed by the people whose land it is in the end. So that's just two from that. I'm going to read the Volta Cinematograph. I don't know if you've come across this, but in 1909 Dublin got its first cinema, which was odd because Trieste, for example, had dozens of them. Now you might think, well, so what? But of course the link is James Joyce, because Joyce was actually the manager of and indeed one of the main partners in the Volta Cinematograph. And I got quite intrigued by this. So this is a poem called The Volta Cinematograph. He was a bit on his uppers then, looking for somewhere to go. He wasn't really very well published then, and he was very short of money. The last few lines are cobbled a little bit from a section in Ulysses, The Volta Cinematograph. Another piss into the chamber pot tinkles its pretty music to eternity and makes me no richer, no wiser. Here was the conundrum. Trieste, full of cinemas. Dublin, not a one. And me puffed as the first tycoon. Ireland's bright cinematographic star. I owed the sisters something, but this work. Am I a writer? Or a Mr. 10%? A ghost of myself? A mere lapwing? Sandwiched and bored between Scylla and Charybdis. I am a wanderer wandering, a hesitating soul, always seeking out adventures. Here's a proverb for our time. a bicycle shop owner and other fools' heads do not a picture house empire make. James Joyce is not to be the Dublin mogul, though a man of genius makes no mistakes. I'd rather swallow a crab than admit nothing can be done here, that once again my city has failed me, has scarred my heart with its name. Time for a quick about turn. Lead me forward. Life will become art. I will be a hero. Chamber music. Chamber music. I can make a kind of pun on that. Diddle diddle. Addle addle. Oodle oodle. Right. 5 minutes left, according to me. So, two poems left. One is a love poem, but it shouldn't be really, because it's about a woman I met at a poetry conference, a poetry event in Kosovo last year. She's written a fantastic book called Carmine Lullabies. She's a Cypriot poet, brilliant poet, lovely person. This is called What Remained. All the flight, I watched your smile, even at takeoff, when all is suspenseful, contingent, when past and present mock each other's pretensions of confidence. I looked at your eyes too. They were deeper than neatly, never chill, but I could not forget anything. Certainly not the women who looked like you on the vineyard roof, close to the brink, the women who held hands to dance in circles to the cliff edge, singing for themselves alone in love, not desperation, whose eyes, though, were dead, whose smiles were fixed for a worse world, who placed their hopes only in the sustaining lightness of air, like that air which held a tiny cloud far below the plain, so lost between sky and parched earth, that I had to stare hard past the wing into the vivid sun flooding the world with carmine lullabies so as not to cry for it, and for what remained, so light could not be kept hold of. Arms have tried as if it was heavy and dense, and it must, like love, eventually, be free. Okay. I've got time for two more poems.
Absolutely. Yep.
Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay, two more poems. This is the other side. This is another kind of love poem. These kind of poetry conferences, like lots of things, get very intense, you know. Do any of you, you know that the television series MASH, that was, it's not on now, it's on a long time ago.
Yeah.
I became quite an addict with that, and I watched the last MASH for time after time after time. It's fantastic. You know,
it's being rerun at the moment.
It's always on, actually, somewhere. The last episode, which was a long one, they're all backslapping, shaking hands, making plans to meet again when they're back in the States. And you know they won't. You know that they will never, ever seek each other out once they've left the Korean Peninsula. And these festivals are a bit like that, you know, you suddenly become intensively friendly with lots of people. Yeah, we're going to do this, you know, it will never happen.
Yeah.
And this poem, yeah, well, it never does, you know, that kind of emotion is particular to the moment, to the time, but there we go. But I said of my Cypriot poet that I was going to stalk her. And this is a poem about stalking. It's called On Nasogoru Street, which is one of the main streets in Nicosia where she lives, actually. So I'm not lying. I am, really, I think my wife would have been. So this is On Nasogoru Street. For a few days in spring, I may steal the sun's first heat. I will take a room on Nasogoru Street. You may remember the hotel. It's small and will prove discreet. I always book the green room. A favourite, I think. It is comfortable if there is waiting or if there is not. Either way. In the mornings, you can find me at a cafe nearby. A shisha, a fresh lemonade. Maybe it will be appropriate then to take that walk to Eleftherias and back. Always the same route. These may become rituals and could be important. Afternoons, I hope to relax on the balcony where I may smoke a cigarette. Looking up from the street, there are the green shutters, the familiar iron scrollwork. You would know it, I'm sure. Should there be a delay for a day or two, I won't worry. There's always an exhibition at the Leventis to occupy me while I wait. It will be some time since we last met. Do you remember the promises of that last night? You looked pale, were deathly quiet, still as the grave. I haven't changed much. You'd know me instantly. I took your smile for safekeeping. You recognize it, shining brightly through me. The last poem. I've got two themes. One is death, and one is love. This is the death poem, in a way. The end of last year, I had several tests for heart problems, and I'm perfectly all right, incidentally. But I started dreaming during that period of an episode of The X-Files, which I also liked a great deal. I also really liked Dana Scully, actually. But anyway, the episode, which some of you may know, I can give you the series location and things if you really want to follow it up. Dana Scully goes into coma, and she visualizes it as being on a boat, on a lake, tethered to a pier. Nobody else appears in it at all. And there's just the empty lake. And the decision she has to make is what to do, really. And I kept dreaming this dream while I was undergoing these tests. So this is called On a Boat with Scully. And this is what won the Red House Poetry 2 weeks ago. On a Boat with Scully. And it uses a lot of kind of X-Files bits, which you don't need to know, but some of you might like a game of picking out the X-Files bits. I want to remember how it all was. I sat with Scully on a boat without oars, tethered to the jetty, a shroud laid umbilical, reefed to the world. We argued. She'd been here before. Loosen that knot, and you'll never get back to the shore. I caught adrift. But maybe there are no choices to be made, no signs to point the way. The lake was deadpan. A breath would barely fog the mirror calm. I don't see Scully now, but I want to believe. Except it's all unraveling. As a strand looses the tide, I'm unremembering all those moments which coasted me to this boat on this lake, eyes closed, opening only once to look. That's where I've been all this time. Reach for the rope. Let's go. Out there? Out there. Thank you very much.